Whether it's her first Mother's Day or her 40th, she deserves more. Shop tons of stunning on-trend jewelry for every budget at Diamonds Direct. Diamond fashion jewelry, beautiful birthstones, everyday pearls, starting at just $200. Commemorate the real loves of her life with a gorgeous pendant featuring the birthstone of the one who made her mom. This Mother's Day, Diamonds Direct has everything you need to say thank you. Diamonds Direct, your love, our passion. Online at DiamondsDirect.com.
This is your moment, your time to shine, your comeback. You're ready for the next step in your career, and you want an education employers respect. So you're not just going back to school. You're coming back with Purdue Global. Backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected public universities, Purdue Global is built for people who bring their life experience into the online classroom. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Live Nation presents Concert Week. Now through May 14th, get $25 tickets to over 5,000 shows. That's up to 75% off a summer full of your favorite artists like 21 Savage, Alanis Morissette, Cage the Elephant, Celeste Barber, Dierks Bentley, Fade, Hootie and the Blowfish, Janet Jackson, Kidz Bop Kids, Meghan Trainor, Pistol Puma, Sarah McLachlan. Get tickets to more than 5,000 summer shows for just $25. Until now through May 14th. Visit LiveNation.com/Concert Week to learn more and plan your summer with Sean Paul, Sum 41, 30 Seconds to Mars, and Two Door Cinema Club.
My name is Craig Ferguson. The name of this podcast is Joy. I talk to interesting people about what brings them happiness. Meet Julie Demarest. Julie is an interesting person. She's worked with disadvantaged, mentally ill, homeless, and marginalized people for a long time. She's a social worker, but has a very interesting story to tell. Let's start at when you stopped doing...
Last year.
Right.
Yep.
Well, when you stepped away from working What do we describe it as? Social services? Do we call it working with the homeless?
Yeah, I mean, I have a bachelor's of social work, so I just say I was a social worker to make it easy for people.
All right. So you like to make things easy for people.
Yep, yeah.
So you stopped doing it last year because of the machete attack.
So I was already very, very burnt out.
Right.
And I had put myself through massage school 2 years earlier because I knew I needed like a long-term out. I didn't think I would quit when I did.
Right.
But the nonprofit I also worked for screwed me over pretty hard as well at the same time as the machete attack. And the executive leadership handled it poorly. Like the machete attack happened, they called me, and I had to go in and handle everything.
Talk to me about the machete attack briefly, just because it's such a dramatic sounding thing.
I know. I feel like I talk sometimes about my jobs and I'm like, oh, yeah, you know.
Yeah. Well, to those of us who have been lucky enough to avoid machete attacks so far, it's kind of... So talk to me a little bit about what happened, and then I want to talk to you a little bit about burnout, and then we'll go back and we'll kind of look at your journey through through the thing.
I used to oversee a drop-in center in Albany, New York.
So that's homeless people drop in?
Yes. Well, the drop-in center, anybody could come. We would ask no questions. So if you just needed to stretch your budget, like if you were on, you know, assistance or anything like that, we had free laundry, we had free showers, and we served two hot meals a day. You could bring your kids. We had mailboxes, because if you're homeless, you don't have an address, but you need to get your paperwork. We just wanted the community to be able to kind of utilize this building.
And who finances this? Is this a...
So the state and the county would not touch that program because it was so low barrier.
Right.
So that was all funded through in-kind, like, donations and grants.
Okay. So what happens with... Did you have someone who came in with a machete and attacked a colleague of yours? Or what?
Yeah, so he was a client that we've known very well. I've known him for years, the whole time I worked there. Very mentally ill. So I can see both sides of what kind of happened. And he was just having a not good mental health day. He had a machete in his locker that we didn't know about. So the manager there, he'd had an altercation, just like a verbal altercation. So they kind of told him, why don't you take the day, you know, take him food to go and just call it a day and we'll try again tomorrow. And he said, well, I want to get some stuff out of my locker. And that's when he pulled out the machete and went to go attack a different staff member. Another guy stepped in the way and almost lost both his hands and his foot.
So it was dramatic and it was bloody and it was violent and, and scary. And you were right there when it happened.
I wasn't there when it happened.
Right?
The executive director called me afterwards and I had to have all the staff leave. I stayed with the police. I brought the crime scene cleaners in the next day, stuff like that.
And that was it. You said, okay, I'm done now. This is it. This is the final straw.
And it was a little like ironic because when I was 19 at my very first shelter, a girl pulled a machete on me. So I was like, all right, full circle.
All right. Okay. So it has a dramatic. Yeah. So let's go back to then. You're 19. What? You're a striking looking person. You have a lot of tattoos.
Mm-hmm.
You clearly have made a journey in your life. You made some decisions. Like, I have tattoos. Mm-hmm. I made decisions to get them. There are reasons I have them. So you have this appearance and you have this story. So can you talk to me a little bit about what gets you to, you're 19 years old and you decide, I want to do this?
So I don't even really know. My childhood and my teens have, you know, some nice childhood trauma thrown in there.
Right.
And I think, so when I was like going to college, I had no idea what I wanted to do. Just kind of went to a community college for liberal arts and I ended up taking a juvenile delinquency class. And there were a couple women in that
class.
So
that's when you study juvenile delinquents then? Is that what
they probably renamed it by now.
Yeah,
I feel like that's not, that's probably not PC anymore. But
right.
Two of the women in the class were human service majors.
Right.
And so I got to talking to them and I was like, what is that? And I think given the childhood that I had, you know, there was, you know, addiction and different traumas in there.
So did you your parents were addicts or
yeah.
Right,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And I think I knew that, like, I knew that life. I knew how to handle that life. I was more comfortable in chaos. This is before I actually knew all this, you know, like subconsciously.
Yeah, yeah.
So I was like more comfortable in chaos. I was more comfortable focusing on other people to take care of them.
Right.
And so I think that's why I was so drawn to human services. I didn't know at that time I wanted to do homeless services. It wasn't until that internship that was randomly picked for me.
I think that that's interesting that you said you were more comfortable in chaos because I very much mm-hmm. identify with that.
Yeah.
I remember going to a 12-step meeting in a Caribbean island once years ago, and a fight broke out during the meeting and people were yelling and screaming at each other. And I remember thinking at the time, I should not feel as comfortable as I do here.
Yeah.
It's a strange thing that, isn't
it?
Yeah,
like I've broken up grown men with knives fighting, but like I'm nervous to come to this. Like it's...
That's interesting because this is, I mean, you're totally safe here. but maybe it doesn't feel that way. I don't know. I mean, it's because we're talking about you.
Yeah, that makes me uncomfortable.
Yeah, that's kind of interesting because you don't get to control the narrative.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, it's like I made a decision to stand up on stage.
Mm-hmm.
I do stand-up comedy and people talk about how nervous it would make them to be public speaking. I'm like, no, I would totally sleep on a stage if I could. I get it. So I understand the idea of being comfortable in chaos and coming from a chaotic childhood.
Mm-hmm.
So did you ever get attracted to that kind of thing yourself? I became very, you know, I was hopeless. I was a hopeless drunk for years.
I drank a lot right up to my mid-30s.
And did you feel like it was an addiction issue for you? Was it a coping mechanism for you? Or
so looking back, it was definitely coping. Like I would have a quote-unquote normal day, you know, at work, doing Narcan on people, suicide attempts, and
that's not normal. That's not normal.
And then I would just be like, man, I can't wait to go have a drink later with my friends. And I was more of a binge drinker. Like,
right.
I wouldn't drink like every day, so to speak, but when I would go out, I love whiskey and I would just pound my whiskey.
I understand the love of whiskey. I also, unfortunately, whiskey hates my guts,
so
but I love whiskey.
I decided in my 40s I'm done with whiskey. So.
Right, okay. Can I just, as a sidebar, ask you what whiskey you drank?
I'm a Jameson girl.
Okay, I understand. That's fine. Not
everybody gets it. If I want to be fancy, I do Kilbeggan.
Okay. I feel you missed out because the whiskey I always liked most was a whiskey called Highland Park. Did you ever have that?
No, I don't think so.
It's an Orkney whiskey.
Okay.
So it's from the the islands off the north coast of Scotland. It's very smooth.
I mean, I still am, I'll have a little here and there. I used to literally have a glass because I love to drink it.
Right.
And then in my like town where I'm from in Albany, like we say hi with shots, we say bye with shots, we like do shots in between everything. So I would just chase whiskey with whiskey and we're not going to do that anymore.
Right. Okay. That's fair enough. No, I'm certainly not going to do it with you. So you're 19 years old and you start getting interested in, because you've had a life which so far, a childhood, which has been, chaos has been involved, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you've been around the unpredictable nature of addicted people. So you get interested in being around it professionally?
Yeah.
You stayed on at college and you did your master's in...
So I never got my master's at 23. I was promoted to a manager.
Right.
So I just rode the management route right up to a director.
So what happens when you become a manager of something like that then? What do you do?
I'm in charge of everything and the staff.
Right. So you're dealing, you know, it's not only HR dealing with people mm-hmm. who are, but you're also dealing with unpredictable, scary.
Yeah.
Who
yeah.
are the easier people to deal with?
The clients.
Clients? Is that what we call?
Yeah. I say clients.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So clients or staff, who's the easiest to deal with?
Clients. Oh my God. I hate managing people. I hate it. Like you're just like managing personalities. Like right before I quit, I was a director and I was overseeing this like 60-year-old man that was just so set in his, and he would just drive me up a wall.
Yeah.
And I hate managing personalities. Just go and do your job, do a good job, and like,
that's
the drama.
Yeah, I know, but I think that's quite interesting because you're dealing with people who are, by their very nature, a lot of them are mentally ill,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yep.
They could be dangerous, they mm-hmm. could, but you find that easier to deal with than the interaction with. Yeah. Supposed normal, stable.
I'm also
people.
Not the most professional in my manner in speaking, so that professionalism to me is a little silly sometimes. So I would cross the line a little bit sometimes with like the way I would speak to staff and just be like, let's just be real. Like this, like when I had to fire people and stuff, like I would just be like, listen, you did this. This is what it's at. I'm the consequence. Like, just stop lying to me.
What gets you fired if you're working in a drop-in shower?
Sleeping with clients, doing
okay.
drugs with clients.
Yeah, that would do it.
And then just your basic like absenteeism, calling out.
Is there
like
a lot of that kind of thing? Is there a lot of like crossover, like people?
Yes, a lot, especially with like direct care, like when you're working the front lines in the shelter and stuff. We liked to hire people that have lived experience.
So a lot of the people are former mm-hmm. clients, if
yeah.
you like.
Yeah.
So how do you transition someone from a client into someone who's working for you? How do they
need a lot of training.
Right.
And I think that's where quite a few of the agencies I worked for lacked that. They kind of had this expectation of the staff to just be like, well, they have lived experience, they'll get it. And it's like, no, they still need to work on boundaries, and the boundary piece wasn't really there.
What do you think? Because you worked in Albany and then you worked in the South, right? Didn't you work in South Carolina?
Yeah, but nobody would hire me because I quote unquote ruined God's temple with my tattoos. Literally two jobs turned me down.
Really? Because you ruined God's temple with your tattoos?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Wow.
So I got hired at a inpatient drug and alcohol rehab, which was ironic because I was 24 or 25.
The alcoholics
at the bar,
will take
like,
everybody.
Yeah, like I was like, oh my God.
What did you ever like when you were dealing with inpatient alcoholics, were you like, this is kind of, I feel like this is getting a little close to.
Yeah, I didn't care. I didn't care for addiction just specifically.
Right.
I didn't like that setting. I'm a harm reduction type of person. So
explain that to me.
So harm reduction is kind of the new quote unquote thing. So instead of cold turkey, which a lot of people can't, and then they fail. They try to do cold turkey, they fail. So then they just like, you know, go all in.
Right.
So harm reduction, like if my client smokes crack and he comes to me and he says, I only smoke crack 3 times today, not 5. That's awesome. Let's celebrate that. Like reducing and like, so
Does
you used to
work?
Smoke crack and you're only smoking weed. That's awesome. Let's like
yeah.
focus on that. And it works for a lot of people because then there's not the expectation that if you slip up,
yeah.
you fucked it all up.
Yeah, it's funny that because
some people need cold turkey. My ex-stepmother needed just, you don't touch alcohol.
Yeah, that's my story for sure.
Yeah.
I mean,
And some people need that.
I used to love saying to people when I was lying to people saying that I was getting sober and I wasn't.
Yeah.
I would say, yeah, they told me that I need to taper off.
Yeah.
That's what they used to
yeah.
I need to taper off. But I think that, you know, in the treatment of addiction, I mean, I'm only an expert in my own,
mm-hmm.
not anyone else's. I'm not involved in it. But I wonder if you hold with the notion of or if you've seen it, you know, the allergic reaction notion that like one drink is the one that mm-hmm. gets you drunk. I mean, for me, that
mm-hmm.
is a profound thing. I
yeah.
mean, if I have one drink, it's like, it goes crazy. It's,
yeah.
it's a light switch flip.
Yeah.
Have you seen that? Do you think is that something that you...
Oh, absolutely. I've seen
yeah.
that. I think too, for me, working with this clientele with addiction, like I'd probably be using something too if I'm sleeping on the streets and the things that are happening. So like if we can kind of work with, okay, you're not doing fentanyl. You know, right. You're just doing...
Well, fentanyl,
this,
it like, seems to mean that people doing fentanyl just die. I mean, it...
So, weirdly, you can build a tolerance. I had many clients that just...
Is that... I had no idea.
Fentanyl, yeah. It's wild.
So, you did mention it there about if they were living on the streets, or if you were living on the streets, yeah. You would do it as well, and I get that.
Yeah.
It's a kind of chicken and an egg thing mm-hmm. for me. Like, what do you think comes first, or is it in a case-by-case basis? Do you start doing drugs and you end up on the street, or mm-hmm. you're on the street and you end up doing drugs?
So the childhood comes first. I would say 98% of my clients have extreme trauma in their childhoods, or, well, which is still trauma, but, like, your parents used, you were in a, you know, crappy upbringing, and, like, 98% of my clients had just horrific, horrific, like, childhoods that just kind of led them, you know, in a direction.
How do you get that information out of your clients when you're dealing with them? Does it come out naturally in conversation?
Especially when I was just a caseworker. Like, when I was a director and things of that nature, I didn't always have a caseload.
Right.
But when I was a caseworker and things, like, we'd have to talk about those things to kind of focus on, all right, if you want housing, like, these are the things we have to work on. So we'd work on, like, daily living skills, symptom management, substance abuse services, and kind of link them to different providers and things. But we'd have to talk through, like, you know, what's your history? How'd we get here?
Did you find that difficult to deal with when people were telling you stuff that was clearly...
I didn't think I did. And then I learned about secondary PTSD and how just listening to those things over and over and over again, like, there's no way it doesn't have an impact on the person. That you might not be living it, but you're the one that has to sit with the person who did and hear those things over and over again.
I think that makes sense to me. Mm-hmm. The idea of that. I mean, but if you're taking that, and I'm kind of interested in how you survive that, because you're still, like, if I'm thinking, like, you doing this, if you're a case, you're still a young woman,
mm-hmm.
and you've had a pretty hard time yourself mm-hmm. coming up. So how do you cope?
So, I mean, for my 20s and stuff, I partied a lot.
Right.
That was kind of my outlet. It was hard for me. Like, I would have a guilty conscience knowing how some people live and how my clients were living. If I, like, traveled or went somewhere nice or did something nice for myself, I just kind of always had this weird, like, even now I have guilt that I stopped.
Right. So a kind of deservability thing?
Yeah. Like, I just, like, it's still happening. I think Tomas knows this story, but twice I have just, like, burst out crying, blackout drunk, that I've not saved all the homeless people.
Yeah.
I don't understand our society, how we just can look, especially LA. Like, when people are in LA, they're shocked about, my God, there's homeless people everywhere. And I'm like, yes, like, this is kind of the epicenter. But nobody really does anything. And I don't, like, it's a weird collective just acceptance that that's just...
Well, let's talk about that. Let's talk about LA, because that's kind of what led us to this conversation. Anyway, I lived mm-hmm. in LA for 23 years.
Mm-hmm.
And in the time that I lived there, homelessness went from being something that I didn't see often. It was definitely there.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
I mean, but it was, I understood that Skid Row was downtown.
Yeah.
And people, you know, talked about it. I didn't go there. I didn't see it. It seems to me that Skid Row has exploded mm-hmm. all over Los Angeles, mm-hmm. Town itself.
Skid Row has a mayor, and they have, like, rules.
And that's kind of interesting. But that fascinates me, because mm-hmm. this is clearly people who are outsiders, society, mm-hmm. and yet they're looking for structure.
Yeah.
Do they have, like, a hierarchy? Is there a way of...
Skid Row has a little bit of it. One that sticks out to me is on Oahu. There's actually...
In Hawaii?
Yeah.
Right.
There's so much homelessness. There's actually on... So if you are a native to Hawaii,
mm-hmm.
they cannot remove you from any beach.
Okay.
So that's why you'll see, like, a lot of encampments on beaches in Hawaii. And there's actually, like, a little town that homeless people put together. There's, like, little roads you can't use in town. People there have jobs and kids and everything. They just can't afford to live. And so Skid Row is kind of its own chaos. But there are, like, the people that have been there a long time, and this is my spot, and you don't go here, and this person is that person. Like, there is a little bit, but the drug use is so active there that it's just kind of a free-for-all.
And has that changed? And we were talking about L.A. in particular,
yeah.
right?
Mm-hmm.
Has that changed because of the new drugs?
So I will say, like, when I was 19 in the shelter and people would come home, like, high on crack or heroin or something, I knew how to handle it. It didn't bother, it didn't, like, make me nervous.
Right.
These new drugs, just, some of them just cause straight psychosis, and it's terrifying. Like, you don't quite know how you can even, like, handle somebody.
So what, I'm fascinated by the idea that, because when I was taking drugs and alcohol, I was looking for relief. Mm-hmm. Right? I was looking for relief for who I was, mm-hmm. or how my brain worked. I didn't know I was doing that. I right. thought I was just having a drink.
Yeah.
But if you have someone who is, I mean, taking drugs that go straight to psychosis, and mm-hmm. presumably many of these people are in psychosis mm-hmm. anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So you're just like, you're changing deck chairs on the Titanic, basically,
yeah.
right? How did it get them? And how does it come in? Are you aware of how that happens? Did you notice a change in how the drugs came in? Was there a noticeable...
I don't really know that part well.
Right.
I just watched the shift over like the 20 years to more synthetic, which
right.
is just wild. Like K2, synthetic weed,
right.
can just cause straight psychosis. And it's like, why don't you just smoke weed?
Yeah. The weed thing, but, for me, weed, I went to, like, right at the beginning, I'm talking 30 years ago, 35 years ago,
mm-hmm.
when I smoked weed, just old-fashioned weed,
yeah.
I went straight to psychosis. It never agreed with me.
Yeah.
You know, I think there's a bit of a myth about weed. Like, I've had this conversation with people about...
I mean, I smoke every day.
Yeah. Oh, you do?
Every night. I'm not a wake and baker. I can't function.
Well, that's interesting because I hate weed. I mean, I hate it.
Like, if I had to choose, I would choose weed over alcohol.
Oh, no. No, girl. You're so not... We're not on the same page here. I hate weed, and I hated it when I was drinking.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't anything other than... It didn't work.
Yeah.
Right? I think that's what I'm saying is it didn't do what alcohol did.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we're looking at the people, your clients,
mm-hmm.
the people that you're dealing with, they clearly aren't finding drugs that work.
Well, no, but the whole point is to just not be present with where they're at in life.
Is there a demographic breakdown that you're aware of?
Honestly, it's across the map.
Yeah.
Like, people used to ask, you know, if it was more men than women, if it was more African-American than white. But to everything that I've seen pretty much was, like, right down the middle. A little bit more men, because for women, if they have children, they can go into family shelters. And they get
right.
a little bit more services. There's a little bit more funding in that kind of pool. So that's why you might see more men in that way, because the women with their children might not necessarily end up on the streets.
Right. You know how you can make your summer vacation better? Is with Cozy Earth's luxurious bedding and loungewear. It's like being at home, but also going away. It's great. And now you can get 35% off. You can get the unmatched softness. It's really as buttery smoothness of Cozy Earth's bedding. It's better than the finest hotels, and you get a really good night's sleep on your travels. And that's important. It's travel-friendly. It's hassle-free. Cozy Earth's bedding comes in adorable totes, making it the perfect companion for your adventures near and far. You can stay cool and comfy during long flights, and you know what that's like, with the Cozy Earth temperature-regulating bamboo joggers and pullover crew. Makes you look cool when you're traveling. I like it. Well, as cool as I can look when I'm traveling. So discover your next destination for ultimate comfort at Cozy Earth. Visit CozyEarth.com and use our code JOY at checkout, and you'll get 35% off. And let them know we sent you after the checkout. Promo code JOY. J-O-Y. JOY. This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. Look, everybody has stuff that stresses them out and annoys them, and I'm no different from anybody else. For example, I get very irritated that people that wear shoes that look like feet. That's not a big deal, but it's a big deal to me. Obviously, there are much more important things to get worried about. Get them off your chest. When you keep them bottled up, it starts to affect you negatively. Now, therapy is a safe place to do that. That's what I did. And you figure out what's going on with you, work it through, and then let it go. Let it go, you see, that's what I think. I've done a lot of therapy, and I have to say I'm a very satisfied customer. If you think I'm kind of tense now, you should have seen me before I started. I really do recommend it. If you can do it, you should do it. If you're thinking of starting therapy, I'd suggest giving BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, it's designed to be convenient, it's flexible, and it's suited to your schedule. All you have to do is fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with, you know, a licensed therapist, a proper one, and then you can switch your therapist at any time for no additional charge. I just think it's a good idea. Give it a shot. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/joypod today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/joypod.
Become a part of the fast-growing health and wellness industry with an education from Trinity School of Natural Health. Trinity graduates can empower their communities through natural health principles and techniques, whether they go into practice to guide others toward their wellness goals or open a store to sell their favorite health products. Trinity grads are equipped to change lives. With 19 online programs and flexibility to fit your busy schedule, including the popular Certified Natural Health Professional, you can get the training that helps you turn your passion into a career. And here's the best part. You can earn the certification in less than a year. From herbology to naturopathy and health coaching, Trinity allows you to make a meaningful difference by helping others live healthier, happier lives. Don't wait any longer to pursue your passion for natural health. Enroll today at trinityschool.org. That's trinityschool.org.
I want to talk to you a bit about abhorrent behavior.
Mm-hmm.
Because obviously, if you're dealing with people who are in psychosis or mentally ill, there's going to be behavior which you just are going to be very uncomfortable with, like criminal behavior.
Oh, yeah.
Machete attack, I guess.
Mm-hmm. A lot of sex offenders.
That's what I was going to say. You dealt with...
in Portland.
Yeah, you dealt with, was it level five?
Four.
Level four. Yeah. Now, I don't know what that means. Can you explain the level
thing? That's the most egregious. So that is a violent rape.
The violent rapists, and you're dealing with them.
Mm-hmm.
I'm kind of shocked and fascinated how you ended up there. Were you comfortable dealing with these guys?
Yes and no. I was alone giving them group counseling every day. The program interested me because it was run by a psychiatrist. All five of the sex offenders had traumatic brain injuries, frontal lobe damage. So it was kind of this weird little project almost to see if they committed their rapes due to their TBIs or if they were just like straight sociopathic. Because the one guy...
What's a TBI then? That's a...
Traumatic brain injury.
Oh, traumatic brain injury.
Yeah.
Okay, sorry.
And because the one guy committed 30 rapes prior and then the one woman ran him over with her car causing his TBI.
Mm-hmm.
And he always had to be on suicide watch because he was just like... disgusted in who he had been. Like, it completely reversed him. It was very weird.
I gotta say, the woman that ran him over, I'm kind of...
Right? I was like, let's just run them all over, I guess.
Yeah. So there's the answer. Let's get them all and run them all over.
Yeah. And then there's a small part of me as a social worker. All five of them had incredibly traumatic sexual abuse history in their childhoods.
Yeah.
So I can see... I don't condone, obviously, anything.
No, of course
but I can
not.
Understand... why they may have turned out the way they did.
Well, I think that's the thing. I mean, the argument is also so many people have trauma in their childhood. You have trauma in your childhood.
Mm-hmm.
I have trauma in my childhood and, you know, we didn't go that way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, you know, you went, in fact, the completely opposite direction. You ended up being in a situation where you were nurturing, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to me that your drive is that, right? That you,
mm-hmm.
because you even now, as you walk away from that world,
I'm still in a career where I'm helping people in a different way.
Right.
Yeah.
So now you're doing massage therapist,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
So what do you think it is in you that causes you, makes you want to do that? Put it right. Is it the childhood thing, you think?
I don't know. I think, like, for as long as I can remember, I just don't understand how as fellow human beings, we just don't take care of each other. It's just a weird, I don't know, it's weird to me. So I feel like I have selfless tattooed on the insides of my hands to kind of remind myself that my hands are here to serve other people if that's what, you know, they want. And I just think that while I'm here, I should be helping other people. Otherwise, what's kind of the point?
Well, that's kind of interesting. So what is the point? Are you a religious person? Are you a
spiritual person? Oh my God, no. I don't think there's any point to life.
There's no point to life?
Not really.
But that's interesting because you fight so hard to make it better.
Yeah, well, while we're here, like, life sucks. Life sucks, basically. Like,
right.
You know, most of the time for a lot of people. And so, like, if I can, as long as my presence doesn't cause any, like more pain for somebody or cause your day to be any worse, like, I want to, like, help that for people. Like, I don't want to, like... I don't want my existence
that sounds like
to make
a, like an informal Buddhist to me.
It's so I do
first do no harm, right?
I study Zazen meditation. That was one of the things that I started to do at like 35 to kind of work on my mental health because I knew I was really burnt out.
Describe burnout for me, because burnout is a kind of catch-all term. You hear actors saying, "I'm burnt out from all the pretending I've been doing." I mean, it's like, so what's burnout for somebody that's on the front line of a very difficult career like yours?
My patience was much shorter with clients, which I did not like.
Right.
It was a disservice to them. I wasn't sleeping. I was also on call for last 10 years of my career.
So that's just like the phone goes, you gotta go?
Yeah. So I wasn't sleeping. I was, you know, drinking a lot. My patience was, you know, thin. I just didn't want to be at work. Like, you know, things like that. I have depression. And so I would just kind of pummel sometimes, like, down in some bad areas. But
how is your life with, you know, outside of work? Are you in a committed relationship? Do you find it difficult to do that?
I used to. So I'm engaged now.
Congratulations.
Thank you. And he's great. He's like the kindest person. We just met not even 2 years ago. Before him, I loved to be alone. I always kind of dated people that I knew I had an out.
Right.
Because I didn't want to stick around very long.
Right.
So, yeah.
So, you're not in any way religious?
No. So, I am, I hate this term, I guess you would say spiritual.
That's okay.
My mom died when I was one. So, I kind of learned right off the rip that, like, tomorrow's not promised and, like, there's something happens.
Wait. So, your mom died when you were one.
Mm-hmm.
So, you don't remember your mom, right?
I don't. And, she was, like, erased from me, so I didn't know her name or see a picture of her or know what she died of until I was 16 because I snooped through my dad's stuff.
Did you ever experience any guilt about that?
No, because I didn't know anything.
Right.
It's just funny.
I've heard people who, you know, their parents died when they were young and they've talked about a weird sense of guilt.
No, I had no guilt. I think because she was hidden from me, I just had, like, anger.
Right, sure.
Like, I feel
that that's...
Her side is Irish, so we don't ask questions.
Yeah, I'm very familiar with that.
We don't talk about it. We don't ask questions.
Oh, my God. That's so,
everything's fine.
Yeah. Oh, it's great. Aye, fine. Everything's fine.
Yep.
Uh-huh. That's great.
Yep.
You'll have a drink.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. What about... So, were you mad at your dad then?
So, I actually was just in therapy a few years ago. I thought I was going to talk about my mom's stuff because also my best friend died when I was 29. I was with her. She had cystic fibrosis. And so... With her death, I was able to grieve it properly. And I think I started grieving my mom at 30 because I had never gotten the chance to do that. So when I was 37-ish, I think, I went to therapy, thought I was going to talk about my mom, and she kind of skewed it to my dad, who I adore. My dad is my best friend. I moved back from LA for him. Like, I want to make sure that he is very happy because I've seen him in very not happy situations, which was really tough as a kid. And so I would do anything for him. And she helped me, like, understand that I can be angry about decisions he made and still adore him.
Sure,
like,
you can be angry at people you love. Yeah,
yeah.
That's an interesting situation, isn't it, though, when you're mad at people? Because I had kind of that relationship with my mother that I was really mad at her for some things. But she's my mom. What am I going to do?
Right, you know?
It's an odd thing. It seems to me that, look, I'm not a therapist in any way, and I wouldn't dare to try and psychoanalyze you, but it seems fairly obvious that, you know, the trauma of that and seeing your dad in difficulty as you're growing up, that the idea of helping people becomes innate in you.
Yeah. Like, I saw him in some very vulnerable situations, and I don't want people to, I don't know.
Don't want to have that.
Yeah, that's awful.
So what's your take on, then, when there are religious organizations that do that, are they any help? I mean, for example, I don't know, the Little Sisters of the Poor. I don't know. I made that up. But
so I did work for the Salvation Army. That was my first shelter.
Right.
I have a hard time with them because they have like stipulations. Like, there was a rescue mission in Albany, And if you don't go to the Christian service on Sundays, you will only get a bag lunch that day. You don't get the hot meal.
You don't get a whole meal unless you let you sing for Jesus.
Like, I don't, that's not okay to me.
I think conditional charity is a little tricky.
Yeah.
But it's still charity.
Yeah.
You know, mm-hmm. I mean, and maybe, look, just to play devil's advocate with them, then just saying, well, what I want to do is encourage people to get salvation.
Right, yeah. And it works for some people.
For some people, it does. Yeah. I know people that have gotten sober through religion. Mm-hmm. It wasn't possible for me to do that. But I do find as I get older, I become more interested in it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think because as I get older, it's that thing C.S. Lewis said, when death is a horseman three hills away,
mm-hmm.
it's easy to ignore him.
Mm-hmm.
But when you hear the hoofbeats,
mm-hmm.
it's a little more interesting. Do you think, you've clearly seen quite a lot of death and quite mm-hmm. a lot of trauma. Do you think about your own mortality? Has it changed your view of it?
Oh, yeah. I'm like fascinated of what's next, though.
You think there is a next?
I don't know. I'm incredibly open to the concept that there might be something I can't even comprehend, and that fascinates me. Or it could be just absolutely nothing, and I'll never know.
nobody does.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's the fascinating. Has that changed over time?
So the only thing that makes me a little curious is since my best friend died. So she had cystic fibrosis, and it was myself, her mom, and her fiance in the room when she passed. And you drown in your lungs. So for 3 days, she's just drowning in her lungs. So she finally passes away, and there had been this whole, she'd been arguing with her fiance, because she was a crazy little Italian, that he broke the like censored paper towel dispenser in her room, right? So it was like, she just could not let it go. And I was like, can we just get along? You know? So it was like this kind of running joke. And then when she passed, we were all sitting around her bed, you know, we're crying and everything. And her fiance had kind of made the call of like, we need to up the morphine more. Like, this isn't okay, you know? So he was a little nervous that her mom would be upset that he was the one that made the call and it caused her to pass. So he said, you know, he's like, are you mad at me? And, like, it still gives me chills. From, like, across the room, the censored paper towel dispenser just spit out a bunch of paper towels. And, like, nobody was near it. It was the weirdest experience. And I've had, like, a couple weird things with her, like, since she passed. So it just makes me question, and I'm fascinated by it.
Does it make you feel more hopeful about the universe? Because you said in this conversation, you know, life sucks and there's no point.
Yeah.
But I don't think you really believe that.
No, I think life can be beautiful. I think I'm very jaded because of my career and have seen the worst of the worst.
I mean, being through what you're through. I mean, that's an appropriate reaction,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah.
But do you find yourself, now you've been out of it for about 18 months?
Less than a year.
Less than a year.
October last year.
Do you feel a change in your psyche? Do you feel a change in how you
sleep? I sleep about 5 hours a night, solidly. I don't have to take a bunch of stuff to sleep.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, my whole point is, and I moved out to the country. I'm with my fiancé. He's great. We have our two dogs. Like, life's really beautiful right now. And so I've been working on, like, recalibrating my central nervous system out of fight or flight, because that's all I've known, literally, for 40 years.
Yeah,
and so I've told myself I don't want the next 40 years to be just in this state of fight and flight. So
what do you want it to be? What do you want to...
I want to be able to enjoy life. Like, I want to be a happy person.
You seem like a happy person.
I know, everyone says that.
Yeah.
I always have this underlying current of just... I mean, I have depression, so I'm always treading water to just keep my head above the depression. You know, there's things I have to do every day, and like mentally just kind of to just make sure I don't dip.
Right.
And it's just kind of who I am, and... Yeah.
So what would you like to have happen in the future? You just want to keep going the way you are now?
I just want a peaceful life. Like, the 40 years have been not calm. And I chose part of it, you know, with my career, but...
Right.
I just want to be peaceful. I wake up in the morning, I make coffee, I can hear birds, we have a creek in the backyard. Like, that's great.
Yeah, it's kind of like...
I want simple.
It feels like you know the movie True Romance?
Yeah.
It feels like you're at the end of the movie.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, you made it to the beach.
Yep, yeah, we're good, yeah. But
when you think back on your time doing it,
mm-hmm.
do you think that you were better equipped for dealing with that life because of your difficult start?
Oh, yeah. Yep.
I'll tell you where I'm going with this. I'm trying to kind of cover my own tracks, but there's no point. So here's what I think. Sometimes when I see a drunk, I think there but for the grace of God or the universe or whatever you want to say it, go I. And sometimes when I see a drunk, I think, get your fucking act together. If I can get sober, you can get sober. And both of these things can coexist within me. And I don't like when I feel angry at people, but I do sometimes. Does that happen with you?
I don't know that I'm like ever angry because I think I just know I feel bad. Like there's a reason. Nobody would choose to live a life of homelessness. Like it's not great, you know, long term. Like sometimes I would have young clients that thought it was cool and they were just like, you know, they left their parents and they were, you know, they were just doing whatever. But I just, so whenever I see somebody still, like my stomach still turns, like I still feel, I feel bad for them. Like there's a reason they got there. So I'm never like really angry. And I would have clients come through the shelter all the time, you know, just kind of recycling. And it's like, let's just keep trying. I don't know. And it would never get really angry.
What does success look like for a client?
It's totally different. And that was something that I had to learn right off the rip was that my idea of success and my priorities, I cannot put on anybody else. So if I had a client and he was, I got him an apartment and he was housed for 3 months, that's awesome. Like, let's celebrate that. And then if you end up back on the street, we'll just try again.
What do you think? Because you hear a lot of politicians are not my favorite people. But you hear a lot of talk about, you know, the causes of homelessness, the causes of people living on the street. But it seems to me, obviously, that it's as individual as the person who's on the street, pretty much, right? Do you think there is a huge contributory factor? Is there one thing more than anything else that puts people there?
I mean, cost of living.
You think so? Really?
Oh, my God.
Yeah, that's
there's,
it.
I mean, when I would try, I worked with veterans specifically in LA and like trying to find them apartments with the VA like housing voucher was impossible. There's literally nothing we could afford.
Right.
And it's like, that's federal funding. Like, what are you guys doing? You're not even giving us enough money to house anybody.
And these are veterans that you're dealing with as well.
Yeah. And then the VA shut my shelter down.
Why did they do that?
They didn't want to re-up the grant after 5 years.
So
I hate the VA. They are awful. They were awful to work with.
Really? What? Why?
So they brought us in as a nonprofit to open the shelter. I don't know if you know about the whole lawsuit with the VA campus in Brentwood.
I don't know.
So there was a huge lawsuit that was going on for years because they were literally renting out the campus to like UCLA and other things and not providing services to veterans.
Oh, so they were making money on their property.
Yep. And so it was Obama during his, when he was president, shut it down. And so it was called the Great Plan or something ridiculous. And our shelter and drop-in center was kind of the first program to come out of it. So I had to work with a lot of VA people who did not care for how I looked, which was awesome. but and they also didn't pay my paycheck. So, you know, I could kind of be a little bit more free in how I spoke and like the things that they needed. But then once the grant was up after 5 years, the VA just was like, nope, we're not funding it. And
so what'd they put in its place?
There's nothing in there right now.
So veterans have nowhere to live.
They built some housing. So there are some other like programs that came out of kind of the lawsuit, but they shut the shelter down.
Are you ever drawn into, because I can see even just talking to you right now that you're a human being of some passion. And there's certainly, I've sat close enough to Irish women before to know when it's dangerous.
Yeah.
You are not afraid of a fight, that's clear.
Oh, no, no.
Do you ever
think, for other people, not so much.
Yeah, but that's what I was going to say. Do you ever think that there may be a time when you may be drawn into not front line, you know, client care, but taking on the politicians?
Absolutely not. I would lose it.
I think you really should. What I'm saying is I really think you should run for office. I really do. Yeah. I really do. And I'll tell you why. Because you don't want to. And that's who we need.
Yeah.
We need people who don't want to be politicians but don't see a way out of it.
Yeah. And that was like one of like the client everyday stuff. That stuff would sort of burn me out, obviously. But the system and like the federal funding, the state funding, and like all the stipulations. Like even when we would get state funding, it would very specifically would map out, you can pay your case managers this much can go to this, this much can go to this, and that's it. We'd have to prove every year that that's how we're spending the money. Like it's so tightly kind of wound. And then even when you're in the system as a client.
So they basically, they don't let you do your job.
No. Right. They give us like peanuts of money.
Right.
So every nonprofit I've worked for, we'd get state funding or county funding and then also have to beg for donations. And then if you're a client and you're in the system, like say you're getting your Social Security check, which is like maybe $700 a month. If you want to work, if you start working over 20 hours or make a certain amount, they will start to dock your SS check. So like there's really no way out of the system. Like I remember very vividly in college, we read a book called Amazing Grace about when lovely Giuliani shut down, cleaned up Manhattan and shut down the shelters. And it kind of pushed everybody into the Bronx and other boroughs. And this caseworker was talking about how she was helping people in the Bronx and things like that. And she realized that she was just teaching people how to live in the system and how to like it because there's no way out.
Right. So they become
always stuck in my head.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any way you can break it?
We need money.
Need money?
We need money. We need housing. We need like jobs that pay. We need like, yeah.
Yeah, I can't make that happen.
Yeah, I know. Yeah,
that's hard. Julia, it's been an absolute joy speaking to you. You're a fascinating human being. I wish you well. I wish you peace.
Thank you.
And it seems to me that, look, I don't know you very well. I don't think you're done. But I think you need a rest.
I need a rest. I need a break. Yeah, I've that's been in the back of my head, though. I don't know how long I can stay away.
No, that's okay. Yeah. Stay away for a while and get a little... A little me time, maybe?
Yeah.
All right. Thanks, pal.
Yeah, thank
thanks
you.
For coming in.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. It's a simple truth, no matter who you are, that mental health challenges can affect you, and how you manage them can make all the difference. That's why everyone should have access to mental health support that meets them where they are and helps them get through. BetterHelp provides online therapy on your schedule. It's flexible, simple to use, and more affordable than in-person therapy. Connect with a licensed therapist selected just for you. Learn more at BetterHelp.com. That's BetterHelp.com.
This is Amy Brown from Four Things with Amy Brown. Today, healthier is happening at CVS Health in more ways than you've ever seen. It's wellness destinations for seniors, including select locations with Oak Street Health and CVS Pharmacy. It's doctors, nurses, pharmacists, and everyone in between offering quality care and support virtually, in person, and on the phone. It's in-home evaluations through Signify Health and meeting mental health needs through Aetna. And those are just a few of the ways that healthier is happening. To see more, visit cvshealth.com/healthierhappenstogether. CVS Pharmacy, Oak Street Health, CVS Specialty, Signify Health, and Aetna are part of CVS Health. Eligibility and services vary by location and individual.
Become a part of the fast-growing health and wellness industry with an education from Trinity School of Natural Health. Trinity graduates can empower their communities through natural health principles and techniques, whether they go into practice to guide others toward their wellness goals or open a store to sell their favorite health products. Trinity grads are equipped to change lives. With 19 online programs and flexibility to fit your busy schedule, including the popular Certified Natural Health Professional, you can get the training that helps you turn your passion into a career. And here's the best part. You can earn the certification in less than a year. From herbology to naturopathy and health coaching, Trinity allows you to make a meaningful difference by helping others live healthier, happier lives. Don't wait any longer to pursue your passion for natural health. Enroll today at trinityschool.org. That's trinityschool.org.